from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobel Prize-winning neurobiologist Eric Kandel's most vivid first memories are of Kristallnacht in Vienna, 1938. Nazi police banging at the door, charging into his Jewish family's little apartment, the color of the toy he was playing with as they banged. 7 decades later, Kandel has given unique substance to the Holocaust mantra, never forget. His Nobel-winning research is at the forefront of new science unlocking the molecular biology of memory itself. It is not a misty realm of chance and phantoms. It is science, says Kandel. And soon, perhaps, science that saves memory in even the longest lives. Up next on Point, life and the new science of memory with Nobelist Eric Kandel. Joining me now from New York is Eric Kandel, winner of the 2000 Nobel Prize for his research in the science of memory. He's director of the Kavli Institute for Brain Sciences at Columbia University and senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He co-founded and is chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board of Memory Pharmaceuticals, a publicly traded biopharmaceutical company. His new book is In Search of Memory, The Emergence of a New Science of Mind. Eric Kandel, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Tom.
And a little Chopin there, maybe to take us back to those days in Vienna. You write that it was when you were awarded the Nobel Prize and asked to put together an autobiographical essay, it was driven home to you how those events and the memories of them so long ago may have played a real part in driving you into this lifetime of memory research. How do you see the interplay there?
Well, I find in some way that the cliche that life is a circle has certainly been true in my case. I mean, my initial experiences in Vienna as a Jewish kid, the fears that I experienced at that time, my attempt to understand how a civilized group of human beings could recite Goethe and Schiller one day, listen and love Mozart, and the next day do horrible things to their fellow citizens is something that haunted and amazed me. And when I came to the United States, I thought I would try to understand that. I mean, I didn't have that idea when I was 9 years old, but yeah. I struggled with that idea for many years, and I went to Harvard. I majored in history and literature with the idea of trying to understand how the Nazi phenomenon arose. Mm-hmm. And I wrote my honest dissertation on the intellectual, the academic response, the response of different German writers to National Socialism. Mm. And while I was doing that work, I encountered Freud and began to read about psychoanalysis.
Freud, whose apartment had not been so far from your family's apartment in Vienna.
Absolutely right. I mean, we were not on the same economic or social level that Freud was, but we happened to live right close to one another. Mm. I later got to know people who knew Freud quite well, were in the Freud circle, and they really inspired me about the future of psychoanalysis. So I began to rethink what I should do with my life and began to think that maybe I should study psychoanalysis in order to try to understand human motivation better.
In those days, that meant you had to be, that you have to be a medical doctor, so off to med school, but then you saw the whole genetic revolution beginning to unfold in the 1950s and turned again.
That's exactly right, Tom. So while I was in medical school, I continued to have a main focus on psychoanalysis. And even though I took science courses in the first 2 years, the same science courses that I now teach to other medical students, I didn't find them particularly fascinating. Mm. I liked the clinical work. I liked dealing with patients, but the basic science of it didn't appeal to me. But then in my senior year, I had a six-month period in which I could do what I wanted, an elective period, and I decided that even a psychoanalyst should know something about the brain. So I took an elective in neurobiology with a very good person at Columbia, Harry Grunfest. Mm. And to my astonishment, I found working in the lab completely different than reading about science in a course. And this actually has influenced my ideas of how to teach science and also influenced me to take young people into the laboratory to expose them to science the way it's actually practiced, not the way the textbooks describe science.
It also has meant, because of the outcome of that research in the lab, a Nobel Prize for you, but more importantly, real, very real, astonishing advances in our understanding of memory. You say you were initially drawn to the moral questions raised by what you had witnessed and your family had witnessed in Vienna. But as you look back, you're also struck by simply the function of memory. You describe a remote control little blue car that you had when you were 9 years old. They're running it around the floors of the apartment, the floors that those Nazi boots would soon walk across. And your fascination with how you could remember all these dimensions of the geometry of that room, the color of the carpet, the glistening surface of the car after so many years. Is your research beginning, has it begun or more than begun, to tell us exactly how that works?
Two things. One is my research has begun to say something about this, but I should emphasize that I am one of many people working on memory research. And what I describe in the book and what is a fact of life is that the biology of the brain is a discipline to which hundreds, thousands of people contribute, is what is really worthy of celebration. Neurobiology has become a very powerful discipline central to all the sciences, and this unification of the various components that make up brain biology is what emerged in my lifetime. And I've had the privilege to contribute to this, but my work is just one strand of a huge stream, if you will, of knowledge that has emerged, so that we do have a better understanding as a result of a collective effort of how elementary forms of memory are encoded, how they're stored, and in the simplest cases, how they're recalled. And this is a wonderful endeavor because memory is the glue that holds our mental life together. I mean, we remember what we did yesterday. We remember our first love experience. We remember our first day in school. This is the fabric of our life, and memory is the process that weaves the various strands of that fabric together.
Remembrance of things past, Proust called memory, said it was like a rope let down from heaven to draw me up out of the abyss of not being. And even before we get to the science, and it's amazing science, and your path through it is amazing, but memory itself, as you say, the glue, as you describe it, and yet we lose it over the course of life in different degrees, but everyone currently, inevitably, in some degree. Why?
Well, because aging carries with it a few downsides. And with memory, there are a number of different reasons why people's memory weakens with age. To begin with, let me point out that not everyone's memory weakens. So if you take 100 people who are age 70, who are in good health, don't have any mental or physical illnesses, and you test them for memory loss, you find that 40% function as well in their 70s as they did in their 30s. This is called successful aging, and it affects a significant number of people.
And everybody wants it.
Everybody wants
yes.
it. The remaining 60% show evidence of memory loss, initially quite mild, and then with time, that 60% splits roughly into two equal parts. 30% go on to have a mild form of memory loss, which is variously called non-Alzheimer memory loss or age-related memory loss or, euphemistically, benign senescent forgetfulness.
Okay.
The other 30% go on to a devastating disease, which is Alzheimer's disease. Now, it turns out that even though we at the moment have nothing effective in the market for either of those conditions, there is reason to believe that over the next 10 years, there will be substantial progress in treating both age-related memory loss, non-Alzheimer disorder, and age-related and Alzheimer's disease. There are lots of biotechnology companies, lots of scientists, even big pharmaceutical houses working on these disorders, and progress is being made. To what degree this will, you know, eliminate this as a problem is hard to predict. It's an enormous problem. If you look at the problem of cancer, we've been fighting the war against cancer for a very, very long time. And, you know, periodically we make some significant headway. But it's a major, major problem, and one has to be realistic in one's expectations.
But the expectations around this whole area of science are huge, as you say, on the other side of memory, beyond that consciousness itself and understanding there, and eventually maybe even insight into the limits, the nature of free will. Eric Kandel, I'm looking in the book here. You've reproduced photographs of that time, Jews forced to scrub the streets in Vienna to remove political graffiti advocating a free Austria then, crowds of people waving swastika flags, Hitler in Vienna before a mass crowd. These photos are so potent. But then you remind us memory doesn't need photos, these flashbulb memories of emotionally charged, vivid, significant events. In your case of that night where the Nazi police were banging on the door and the details of that room with a toy car, take us in to what's happening when those flashbulb memories are created. What do we now know about exactly how that really works?
Well, we know that emotional events, emotionally charged events, have a very powerful effect on the brain, that free certain inhibitory constraints that normally limit memory storage. One of the surprising things that has emerged in the study of memory is that the nerve cells have built into them certain limiting factors, certain inhibitory constraints that prevent the switching on of long-term memory. Long-term memory involves an alteration in the expression of specific genes, and there are police people, if you will, standing in front of those genes, molecular policemen, that prevent genes from being turned on. You may ask, you know, why would you have that? Wouldn't you want to put everything into long-term memory? And the biological reason seems to be no, that unless something is terribly important for you, you don't want to put it into long-term memory, so that you have to overcome a number of hurdles, push aside these guardians in order to store something in long-term memory. And emotional events are particularly effective in removing these inhibitory barriers. And when something dramatic happens, like the police people knocking on our door or the horrible events of 9/11, those inhibitory constraints are dramatically removed and you quickly put into long-term memory the details of the events that you experienced, the smell of the room, the atmosphere, the mood of the people that you were with, as well as the visual imagery that that room created for you. And this is how we hold on to certain important events for the rest of our life, our first love experience, the first day in school, the day of our marriage. Many important events are of that nature.
The science is amazing, and I think maybe we need to step back because I really want to get closer to understanding it here. When you talk about the expression of genes in adult life or in childhood, I think many people associate the genes with reproduction and transmission there, but not so much with in-life
activity. Yes, Tom,
activity.
I think it's a wonderful point, and I should elaborate on that more.
Well, I wonder if you might do it in this way. If you could take us back through, I mean, your Nobel Prize came, if I've got it right, for really a lot of it for your research with snails, aplysia snails, these great big snails off California that you use as your kind of highway into understanding mind. Maybe that would be a beginning path to get us toward understanding.
So let me first step back and tell you why I selected to work with the snail, because it represents a common strategy within biology. Mm-hmm. What one wants to do within biology, what many people want to do within biology, is to take a problem that is cosmically important and try to find the simplest representation of it in the universe and then study it as completely as possible. And so I realized after a while that memory is a very complex topic, which I wanted to understand, and I couldn't understand it in all of its richest ramifications. I needed to take a very, very simple example of it, one that was technically suitable for study, and try to drive it into the ground, try to understand it rigorously. The main techniques that modern neurobiologists had in the late 50s and early 60s were the ability to record from individual nerve cells. And in order to use that technique effectively, you needed nerve cells that were large. So I looked around for an animal that had the largest nerve cells available, and that turned out to be marine snails. And one of them, called the Aplysia californica, has the largest nerve cells in the animal kingdom. Its nerve cells are not only large, but they're so characteristic that each nerve cell can be given a different name: Jane, Harry, Tom, Louise, and you can return to the same cell in every animal of the species.
Their function is so identifiable.
So uniquely identifiable. Then you can work out the pattern of interconnections between the cells, and you can see how different patterns of interconnections give rise to different behaviors. So I use that in order to work out the neural circuit, the wiring diagram of a very simple reflex. And I found that this reflex could be modified by very simple forms of learning. So I could see what does learning do to the neural circuitry of the brain, and how does this come about. And what I found is that if you take the wiring diagram, the neural circuitry, for a given behavior, you find that the nerve cells make very specific connections with each other. So if you're dealing with a very simple reflex, the sensory neurons for the reflex make very precise connections to specific motor cells as well as to specific interneurons. Those are cells that are intercalated, placed in between the sensory and motor neurons. And that was very interesting because in every single animal, the same cells connected, the same sensory cells always connected to the same motor cells.
Now, there was a very simple model, but in humans, 70 trillion, if I recall correctly, of these neural circuits?
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Professor.
No, Tom, you're right on target.
Vastly more complicated. Are the mechanics the same? Is memory a matter of mechanics?
It's a matter of biology. Yes. Every mental process, Tom, from the most elementary reflex that you study in the snail to the most cosmic aspect of free will, result from activity of neural circuits in the brain. And the belief of biologists is that evolution is very conservative. Once it finds a set of mechanisms that work, it holds on to this.
Through millions of years of evolution, you're
millions
right.
of years of evolution. And so, and this is proven to be useful time and time again. If you study a problem deeply in any context, you will find that there will be generality that will apply to other contexts as well. This is not to say that the biology of a human memory that takes you back to childhood, as my memory takes me back to Vienna, is based on a neural circuit as simple as I studied in aplysia. Far from it. The neural circuitry involved is much more complicated. But the molecular mechanisms involved in storing information at these many, many neurons that you talked about is likely to share many, many common features with the mechanisms involved in the snail, in the fly, in the worm.
I have a million questions that come from that, and some of them we'll get to, but I also want to let our listeners put their questions to you, Dr. Kandel. Let me turn to Anne, calling from Waverly, Iowa. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not sure if maybe I've had my question answered already, but I find interesting that there are people like myself and Dr. Kandel who have very, very strong, vivid memories from childhood, can picture all types of things. And then there are people like my husband and my son and my sister who seem to claim they have next to no memories of childhood. And I know the theory that sometimes you block things because of bad experiences, but in all three of those cases, for example, there are not necessarily major issues happening.
And it's not a matter of them aging. It's that they've never consciously had these memories, you're saying.
Right. And yet there's other people like myself who I could tell you about when I was two, fake memories from that.
Let us pick that up. Eric Kandel, what about it? We people say so-and-so has a better memory than me or than somebody else. What about the individual variation and why?
Tom, you've identified it completely. I mean, and your husband's nose is different than your nose.
Uh-huh.
His smile is different from your smile. We each have our own biological individuality. You know, he may be better at Greek. You may be better at Spanish. There is a difference that people have in memories. There's a difference that people have in their eagerness to recall their youth. Even if it may have been pleasant, it may not be important to them compared to what they're now living. So there are lots of factors, motivational as well as basic biological differences, that distinguish people.
Biologically, do we all have the memory stored in there like a photo file, and it's just a matter of whether one individual has the motivation to go get them, or do some people simply not have the same storage as others?
Both are true. People vary in their storage capabilities. People's brains differ and the ability to store memory differs. In the limit, I go to the extreme case, you have children that suffer from mental retardation. So as a result of a biological abnormality that interferes with the development of normal neural circuitry or with the machinery that is involved in memory storage, some kids, unfortunately, just don't have the basic capability to store information. In addition, there's the motivational aspect. So those combine, and in the adult, it's hard to tease out which particular component. I presume, Anne, you're surprised with your husband because his memory for other things is very strong.
Exactly. He can meet a person and know the name immediately. Me, I have the worst head for names. So, right.
So Eric,
well, I think this is an, may I, Tom, I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes, please.
To interrupt
no, go
you.
Ahead. No.
It's an interesting difference, if you will. Hmm. So you, if I can put it metaphorically, focus on the big picture, the major events that had occurred in your life and occurring now, and you may not be very good with remembering Tom or Eric.
Right.
Your husband focuses in on the here and now. And so that may be a difference in memory style, if you will. I'm throwing this up. I'm manufacturing this. I've never obviously met your husband. But you can see how there are individual differences that might lead to rather dramatic outcomes after, you know, 40 years of life.
Is this the kind of difference that the science you're pursuing may address? I mean, would Anne's husband take a pill one day and suddenly his mind would be filled with technicolor memories of deep childhood? Or am I on the wrong moonbeam there?
I think you're on the wrong moonbeam. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, insofar as there's a fundamental difference with the way one's mind works, it is unlikely and in many cases undesirable to try to reverse that pharmacologically.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just have to realize that I will never be a major league football player. And this is not because, you know, I'm 76 years old, but because I never would have had those skills. I just don't have those skills.
Mm-hmm.
So people vary in what they can do. Training certainly helps. My tennis game is mediocre. I could probably bring it up a slight notch.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a range of flexibility, but also limits to one's behavior. And I think, to step aside from the particular issue of memory storage, what one has to find in life is the niche in which one can function effectively with what one is given and what one can accomplish with what one is given.
Yeah, and it sounds as though you may be headed to the Childhood Memories Pro Bowl. Your husband may be playing a different sport there, but we thank you very much for your call. Let me get another call from Natick, Massachusetts. Stephen's on the line. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Stephen?
I wanted to ask your guest whether he felt that the high stress of contemporary society, which may cause prolonged anxiety, may be impacting neurologically on statistically increasing memory loss in the culture in general if you try to adjust for increased longevity of human beings.
Stress and memory. Do you see that increasing memory loss, Eric Kandel, and do you see a stress-memory connection?
I think that's a very interesting point, Stephen, and I want to come back to one issue that you just mentioned and then put aside, and that is given the increase in longevity. One of the reasons we're seeing evidence of memory loss in the population is because rather than dying at 50, people are dying much later. So I think you've got to realize that despite the fact that modern life is stressful, it also carries with it biological, medical, and public health benefits that allow us to lead a more vigorous, healthy, productive life for longer periods of time.
But
so
I think
that has to be put... That has to be put in the background.
But I think I heard Stephen suggesting that even taking that into account, there's a memory loss. Is it the fact
that
you know?
We don't know that because people mm-hmm. never lived long enough in the past when we were living in a bucolic universe.
For less time.
Right. I must tell you that I was around in 1937 and 1938, and I'd much rather be in the United States in 2006, although this is a difficult time for this country, but nothing comparable for a Jew in Vienna in 1936 or 37.
Might stress cut memory then? We've just got a minute before the break here, Dr. Kandel.
Stress activates hormones that at lower levels, enhance memory, and when it's great, interferes with memory storage. Those hormones can be beneficial if they're modest. You do better on exams if you're a little bit anxious, but if your anxiety level is too high, your performance begins to deteriorate.
So it can cut both ways.
It cuts both ways. And this is true in any performance. If you're completely relaxed before a tennis match or you're completely relaxed before a performance of a play, you do not do as well as if you have some degree of arousal, some tension in your body.
You raise this kind of path. You suggest that if we understand memory, next comes understanding consciousness, kind of the big one. After that, understanding free will itself. What do you mean when you draw these connections? What is the connective tissue between these?
Well, I mean, consciousness means an awareness of one's life experience. And since the way we use life experience is through memory, consciousness has an important component of it, the ability to recall at will the important experiences of our life. Consciousness carries with it the additional aspect that we are aware of ourselves. So we are distinctive in being able to look at our life experiences and examining it as if it was a book in front of us. And we see ourselves as being unique. We have feelings that we feel as ourselves that are different than other people's experiences that they're having. So it's a very special aspect of existence that we would like to understand. And we're very far from understanding it, but we at least are specifying what the nature of the conscious process is. And people like Francis Crick, who spent the last 30 years of his life studying consciousness, helped us define certain experimental approaches to consciousness. For example, he said one critical feature of consciousness is selective attention, that you're listening to my voice at this particular point. That means you're not attending to other things in your environment, including other sounds that may be going on extraneous to this conversation. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of the attentional process? That's a more doable thing. We spoke before about reductionist approaches. Here is a beautiful reduction of the problem of consciousness, enormously complicated, very difficult. But if we can take a component of it, a slice of it, a slice of life, a slice of conscious life, and reduce it to understanding deeply the nature of attention, we would have made a lot of progress. And I think we're making progress in understanding attention.
Wow.
We see how modulatory transmitters contribute to that. So I think in all of these cases, we're very far from the end point. We know practically nothing about the nature of free will. But we're beginning to see how to approach it. We're beginning to see factors that contribute to it. We're beginning to realize that a lot of mental life is unconscious, and we make unconscious calculations about actions that we're unaware of that contribute to free will. So we're putting together the tools for a long attack on the problem of the mind, if you will. We're mounting the troops, the intellectual troops, for understanding the mind in satisfactory terms.
Memory and then consciousness and all the biggest issues on the table. Ed is calling from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the very basis of memory. I understand that is triggered in the individual neuron, even at a genetic or a gene level, but also surely we're talking about circuitry. What is the difference between interneural memory and intraneural memory?
That's a beautiful... it's a very profound question, Ed. So neural circuits are made up of elementary units, the individual nerve cells. And nerve cells communicate with one another at certain special points of contact called synapses. Mm. And what happens with learning and memory storage is that the strength, the effectiveness of communications between nerve cells is altered. Now, depending upon the complexity of the neural circuit, the change may occur at one site or at a number of different sites. Take the simplest case, a very simple reflex made up only of a sensory neuron and a motor neuron, and let's say there are 5 sensory neurons and 3 motor neurons. Well, then just a limited number of changes at a few synapses could be sufficient to produce a profound alterations in behavior and the recall of that change, all mediated by a limited number of changes. But if you're dealing with a visual image, like how I remember the face of my wife, that involves circuits in the visual system that are quite elaborate, and one needs to change a number of sites within that neural circuit in order to form that memory. There are lots of components to my wife's face. There are lots of components of the clothes that she was wearing as I looked at her face the last time. All of this has to be stored, and that involves much more complex neural circuitry, and the recall is more complicated. So one needs to see it as a continuum. The change occurs at individual nerve cells, but how many nerve cells are recruited depends upon the complexity of the task.
Mm. Ed, thanks for your call. And Eric Kandel, circle back, if you would, to the role of genes here and the gene-level trigger that Ed asked about. Again, I think many people see genes as active in transferring traits from one generation to another. But within a life, within the process of memory, you're describing genes as active players, if I heard you correctly.
Yes, this is an absolutely critical point, Tom. One thinks of genes as being the carriers of hereditary information.
Mm.
And this is not the only way one thinks of it. Genes also, I mean, they do that, but they do additional things. Genes also control the day-to-day functioning of cells, all cells of the body, including the nerve cells. And my work and that of others has shown that when you turn on a long-term memory, you produce a strengthening of connections between cells. And that strengthening takes the form of the growth of new synaptic contacts, a better way of communicating. That growth requires an alterations of genes. So if I remember a face, there will be an alteration of gene expression in certain nerve cells that convey information about face. That's called the visual system, the system part of the brain that deals with external objects, the world around us.
Mm.
That alteration in gene expression affects only those selective nerve cells. It does not affect the sperm or the egg. It is not carried from generation to generation. Therefore, the pictures that I've seen in my life are not passed on to my progeny, or the languages that I learn onto life in my life are not passed on automatically to my progeny. They have to learn that anew if they want to master those languages. And this is one of the insights that really comes from the work of Monod and Jacob, two great molecular biologists working in the 1960s. The fact that gene expression can be altered, This was an amazing insight, and it amazed me when I found that it applies to memory storage.
We've got a question.
Because we are taught to think the genes are the controllers, the governors of behavior.
Right.
What people, by and large, don't realize is the genes are also the servants of the environment. That insofar, Tom, that you and I remember anything about this dialogue we're having together with the other listeners, this discussion we're having, insofar as we remember any of this tomorrow, it is because we have produced changes in each other's brains that will not affect our progeny, but it will affect you and me, insofar as we remember it.
Happy to do it. It's an amazing idea. We do it every day. I guess we all do. But I've got
we
a question.
Do it all the time.
We've got a question to this point. I've got Terrence calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Terrence. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. I'm interested to know to what extent do people who've been through traumatic experiences as a collective group remember those experiences? So I, as a black person, do I have a memory of the Middle Passage? Or Dr. Kendo, as a Jewish person, do you have a memory passed through heredity of the expulsion of Jews from Spain in the 16th century? Is this something that's then activated through culture, through our consciousness, that I'll be able to, if I'm around a white person, I'm going to feel suddenly afraid because I have some memory of being taken, of my ancestor, who was a medicine man in West Africa, who was taken when he was a boy at 9 years old. Am I going to have, is this possible to pass memory to our progeny?
Anything at all, or is it all cultural?
Terrence, that's a wonderful question, and it allows me to sort of explain a distinction between biological evolution and cultural evolution. You do not have a direct memory in your brain of your African heritage, and I do not have a direct memory in my brain of the Jewish experience in Spain. However, we have been raised in a cultural context that has taught us about those experiences. So your parents learn from their parents or learn from their parents about what slavery is like and how horrible it was. And I've learned from my parents, and they've learned from their parents, what the pogroms in Russia was, what the Inquisition in Spain was about. And so one of the things that is, I'm tempted to say unique, it's not rigorously unique, but it's certainly a distinctive feature of human existence, is the fact that we have language, we pass on stories from one generation to another that works in parallel with biological evolution to carry information forward from one generation to another. And in fact, the brains of humans have changed relatively little since the origins of the human species many thousand years ago.
Which means that cultural baggage,
cultural
evolution
is what
important.
Drives our behavior. We have changed much more because of cultural evolution than because of biological evolution. Culture is extremely important.
Amazing. Terrence, thank you for your call. Sheldon's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Sheldon. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much, Tom. My question is a very interesting one, simply because most of us have been provided the impression that horrible incidents in our lives are repressed. And therefore, if you're going to provide the opportunity for long-term memory and enable us to remember the things that we don't want to remember, is that not negative rather than positive?
That's a wonderful question, Sheldon. First of all, the answer to that is not absolutely clear. So if you ask people like myself or people who have had much more frightening experiences like Holocaust survivors, their memory for things that they've experienced is pretty good. So there are lots of horrible things that happen to one's life that are not repressed, number one. Number two, there are things that are repressed. Apparently, many early frightening sexual experiences are sometimes repressed. Why would you want to bring them into consciousness? I don't really know the rigorous answer to that. The teaching of psychoanalytic thought, for which I have a fair amount of respect, is the following, that repression is often not the best way of dealing with it because that material which bothers you is there in your unconscious. You haven't gotten rid of it. And it expresses itself in other ways, psychosomatic illnesses, difficulty in sleeping. So it goes around the censorship and causes problems in other ways. If I now allow you in a protective environment to try to dredge up those experiences from your unconscious, you are in a position to master them as a mature person in a more satisfactory way than the rather unsatisfactory mechanisms of repression that you had to use many years ago. I'm not saying this is a correct explanation. I'm really trying to reconstruct an explanation that many analytically oriented people might give you about that.
Sheldon, thanks for your call and question. And it points us, in the few minutes we've got left, Eric Kandel, to where we're headed here. You've got a company, and there are others who are looking at all those boomers losing memory and trying to come up with pharmaceuticals that would enhance or re-enhance memory. I'm not sure how to put it. What can we expect in the next 5, 10, I don't know, 20 years? What are the possibilities for therapeutically reviving, enhancing memory?
Well, I should make one thing clear. I think that very few people who are working out there on trying to develop drugs or cognitive methods for improving memory, one ought to keep in mind the fact that education itself is a pretty powerful cognitive enhancer. Mm-hmm. And keeping one's mind active in the 60s and 70s and 80s is a good insurance policy.
But your company is called Memory Pharmaceuticals, presumably for a reason.
Yes, we do not do that, but I simply want to state the alternative approach that is also legitimate. Mm-hmm. May in many cases not be as effective, but one ought to keep it in mind. Companies like Memory Pharmaceuticals and many other companies that are trying to develop drugs for age-related memory loss and for Alzheimer's disease do not think that this will allow you to bring back memories that you've lost. They think that these drugs will allow you to hold on to new memories that you're exposed to. So it allow you to acquire new information better and to store it and hold on to it and recall it at a later time.
So you won't lose the car keys, won't forget the conversation from
That's
5
right.
minutes ago. That's pretty That's good
right.
in itself. How close are That's we to right. that? Is that realistic?
Mice, for example, show a non-Alzheimer age-related memory loss that bears a great resemblance to human age-related memory loss, non-Alzheimer. There are now very good drugs at Memory Pharmaceuticals that will reverse that perfectly well. So if you were a mouse, we could cure you. Whether this is going to work in people is uncertain as yet. These drugs are in early stages of clinical trial, and I think within 5 or 10 years we'll have a very good idea. There are a number of different chemically distinct approaches to this issue that a variety of different biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies are taking. So I would think, looking at it objectively, that we're very likely to have improved therapies for both the non-Alzheimer and the Alzheimer age-related memory loss within a decade.
Eric Kandel, this universe is so vast, I feel like we're just getting started on it and already we're out of time. We can't thank you enough for being with us today. I hope you'll come back again and take us further into the realm of memory. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for the book. And thank you for being with us in this hour.
Tom, it was a pleasure. You're a wonderful interviewer. I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Great to have you. Eric Kandel, Nobel Prize winner in 2000, author of the new book, In Search of Memory, The Emergence of a New Science of Mind. Wow, what a world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.